Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Spurs in full cry here.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name's Windy, and I'm joined by one of the most requested guests we have. He's been on here many times before, and we're always very glad to have him. It's Alex Stoyle, who is our friend and a sports psychologist. Alex, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me back.
Absolute pleasure. And we've got some questions from the X-Ups lined up. We've got lots to talk about. Just in case people haven't listened to an episode with you on before, would you mind giving a little bit of background as to your profession, I suppose?
Yeah, so I'm a sports psychologist in training at the moment. So that means I've done all the kind of academic bits of it. And I'm currently working on a doctorate, which will finish off all of my training. So that's at the University of Portsmouth. And I look into essentially sort of underperformance and pressure and the relationship between those. So if you want to paraphrase that, it's basically bottling it, which... yeah, Spurs don't do anymore, it turns out. That's Arsenal's job. I look into that. And then I also work with both one-on-one clients across loads of different sports, ages, all that kind of thing. And then I also work with a couple of organizations. So I'm one of the sports psychology practitioners for England Swimming and for a couple of universities as well. So that's the psychology side of it. I'm also a Spurs fan and season ticket holder. So yeah, qualified across the board.
Thoroughly invested. Lovely stuff. Do you use the phrase bottling it in your thesis as shorthand?
So kind of, yes. Like one of the avenues that I'm going down is sort of trying to understand whether the phrases like choking, mm-hmm. like so choking under pressure, bottling it, like those kinds of phrases, whether they have the same sort of meaning, and particularly, I guess, looking at whether the way that certain terminology that's used in the kind of sports psychology research, like the more academic realm, whether that's the same as how it's used in kind of everyday life. So like if someone on the street goes, oh, they totally choked under pressure, is that how people are kind of using that in the sort of more academic world, and how they're sort of then engineering experiments and things to sort of test various variables or whatever. There's a good chance that bottling it and perhaps even Spursiness will end up in at least one of the papers that I write as part of the doctorate.
Lovely stuff. Yeah, you need to get some Spurs references in there for sure. There are multiple examples, I'm sure, that you can draw upon. So plenty of source material. Let's start off with, I mean, you've mentioned Arsenal bottling it, but of course Spurs did the opposite. And I tweeted about this actually last night. I said that we had a steely determination to us throughout the latter part of the season. And I think that was kind of characterized by Conte's own mannerisms and interviews and general calmness. Can you talk to us a little bit about that and the impact that might have had?
Yeah, and I mean, f- first things first, it's a bit of a surprise to everyone that I'm going to sort of talk about Conte and calmness as an idea. But I think there was a real just sort of assuredness and confidence in the sort of the system and even in the players that he had, right? And particularly we went through a bit of a rough patch with Brighton and Brentford, and that was, you know, a lot of people, I think justifiably, were sort of saying like, this isn't working. You know, we've got to switch this up. We've got to find different personnel. We've got to be a bit more experimental. And Conte just didn't blink. And, you know, I think, you know, there is probably a reasonable amount of kind of just stubbornness at play there. But I think also just that if you are a player like Royale, for example, who had been brought in after Doherty got injured and who was, you know, really pretty bad in those games and you know, is, I don't think he's a bad player in general. I kind of completely agree with the take that the pod kind of generally goes with, that like he could be an excellent player in a system more catered to him, but he was really bad, like to be really honest. And but I suspect that knowing that Conte wasn't going to drop him and wasn't going to sort of tweak the system and was, you know, had faith in him to keep going out there, that could be really, really important, right? And beyond that, I think in terms of the sort of the broader dynamics of the team, and like certainly for a player, for a manager like Conte, where the automations and the patterns are integral, right? Totally crucial to his style of management. Trying to sort of mess with as few components as possible makes a lot of sense. So there is a sort of, you know, as we learn things, right, you know, learn physical skills, learn playing patterns, all the rest of it, right, there's a learning curve, right? And if you've got a team where most players have now actually started to get to grips with that, and then all of a sudden you say, okay, right, so there's a nice little dynamic building between Doherty and Kulishevsky and Højbjerg and Kulishevsky and Kane and Kulishevsky. Then you go, okay, right, well, we've lost Doherty, so we're going to bring in Royale. You've only got kind of like one variable there. There's like one link in the chain that's changed. If all of a sudden you go, all right, we're going to switch it up, we're going to play Kulishevsky as right wing back and bring in Moura maybe as the, you know, the sort of the right side of the attack, like all of a sudden everything's kind of thrown into chaos. And not just because Lucas is a generally chaotic player, but like all of a sudden no one knows where anyone's going to be. And what's really interesting, and this kind of, I guess, touches a bit more closely on the sort of specific research that I do, is like, is there is a, you know, there is a process which has the sort of slightly fancy name of reinvestment, which is the process or the phenomenon in which automatic processes, so processes that you have learned kind of by heart, you've practiced them over and over and over again, and you know what you're doing even without thinking, they start to break down. And it's basically a result of overthinking. So yeah, reinvestment is basically a fancy sort of way of saying overthinking things. But if you started to get the rest of the team to a place where they are doing all of these things automatically, and then you start to sort of change multiple facets of that, there is a real chance that people will start to overthink that. And I think that's possibly even a little bit what maybe did happen in those games where we were pretty bad as a team, right? Was all of a sudden nothing seemed to click and everyone seemed to be second guessing themselves. No one seemed to be quite in the right place. And what may have been happening there was, rather than just sort of like, okay, I know that I run from here to there and then I'm going to kick the ball to that guy over there because he's going to have made this little run, right? All of a sudden, everyone is second guessing themselves, which means everyone's a half yard slower where they're meant to be. They're playing the ball slightly less fluidly. So that's one of the key kind of characteristics of reinvestment, is you go from a nice, fluid, reliable, automatic execution into a like jittery, kind of like tense and awkward execution of it, right? So all of a sudden you could get players who are doing things that they definitely know how to do, and all of a sudden in that moment, because they've been overthinking things, like they may no longer be able to execute it with that same sort of automatic kind of flow and sort of, yeah, that kind of the classic cliche of the sort of like the really good people make it look easy. Well, all of a sudden they start making the easy things look hard. And so, yeah, I think that could potentially have been a little bit of what was going on in those games, and also possibly at other points when we've had our little kind of lulls and sort of dips in form, is like potentially that was just as Conte was adding more elements into the game plan, you maybe started to get people overanalyzing, overthinking, wait, was I meant to be here or there? Or, you know, if I play this pass, is that guy actually going to make the run that I think he's going to? And so you start to get that sort of little, it's not quite so much, I guess, doubt, but it's just that over attention.
I think that makes a lot of sense in terms of explaining what we saw as well. Yeah, I mean, that all tallies for me, because basically the way Brighton in particular played against us was a way that I don't think any other team had played against us this season. And it only takes one or two things to change at the beginning of build-up play for the whole thing to change, because it has to. You know, you're taking a different route out of defence, or attempting to. We actually weren't able to in the end. And that throws everyone off course. And you're right, we did look like we were second-guessing ourselves quite often. Compare that to Norwich, the absolute thrashing, and I don't recall seeing Spurs players playing so much one-touch football as we did against Norwich for a long, long time. You know, there were so many first-time layoffs and first-time passes, and that to me is a sign of assuredness. Players not having to think before they make the pass. They are so adept. I mean, and Norwich stood off us, which obviously helps. It completely helps. But the understanding of the system, I mean, it was almost like a training game in that sense. So I really like that explanation. And Conte's sort of stability, and the way he spoke to the press and to the Spurs in-house media team, and the sort of he didn't ever give off vibes of being panicked, in contrast to Arteta. What impact will that have had on our players?
Yeah, I mean, I think both in terms of the confidence that instills, like in our players, right? Of if you've got this manager who's won everything, right, and who has, you know, already at that point turned the season around. You know, even if we hadn't quite snatched fourth, like, then, you know, but we were still performing far better. We'd had some pretty impressive results against City. We'd, you know, like, we were climbing up the table. Like, all of a sudden the season was looking far more respectable than I think any of us could have imagined, you know, towards the end of Nuno's very short reign. But yeah, there was a kind of, I think when you can kind of feel that the team is playing better, and you've got the manager sort of just refusing to flinch, like, that's going to give you a sense of confidence. And I think what's also quite important, and it's a concept that I think I mention every single time I'm on here, right, is, but it brings things very much back within control of the players, right? Of like, okay, we're not going to keep making random changes just because the press are asking us to. Or, you know, like, you can just sort of say, like, you know, Conte's there going like, no, here's my team. You know, this is how we're going to play. We're going to keep just running the same drills. We're going to keep doing the same things. You guys are going to get the hang of this, and we're going to get better, and we're going to see the results.
And he can point to past performance as well, right? Because, they, you know, in the games prior to the two poor ones, the Brighton and the Brentford games, we had successfully played the system and looked really good.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think, you know, there are, you know, some of these are such fine margins, you know, that had we played, you know, a slightly better, you know, in the first 10, 15 minutes of some of those games, got maybe a slightly fortunate goal, I think, you know, like, it's quite possible everyone would have relaxed.
I
wouldn't have had that same overthinking potentially, and we might have gone on to absolutely smash those teams. So, you know, it's not inconceivable that could have happened, right? And I think, you know, having mentioned Arteta there, like, I think he was a real kind of contrast to that. So after that North London derby, like, he, yeah, and whenever we speak about managers and whatever, yeah, there's obviously the caveat that we don't know what they're saying behind closed doors. We don't know what they're saying to their players. But for him to come out afterwards with the sort of bizarre kind of conspiracy theory chat, and he looked so rattled and so shaken by that result, and rather than owning it and bringing it back to, you know, again, control, right? Bringing it back to, okay, that wasn't the performance we were looking for. You know, we obviously weren't expecting to go down to 10 men, so that made things worse, but, you know, we will learn from this. We're going to, you know, and we're going to put this game behind us. We're going to learn the things we can, and then we're going to move on. Instead, it was such a sort of weird way of thinking about it that is, you know, if he's letting on any of that to his players, it's not a super helpful way to think about things, because you know, blaming it on poor refereeing decisions is not going to be helpful in the long run, because then all you do is start to sort of worry, oh, well, are the whole league out to get me? You're like, and there's nothing you can do about it as the player, right? You can't really change the mind of the referee if they're going to make a decision one way or another. So you might as well be focusing more on your own performance, what you as a team, or you as an individual and you as a team can be doing instead, rather than, yeah, these kind of other factors that are well beyond your own control.
It's really tough that managers have to come out after such a kind of emotional 90 minutes or whatever, and have to sort of face up to such severe scrutiny. But I was surprised by the way Arteta handled himself. It kind of seemed really out of character for him, to be honest. I've never seen him behave like that before. But also, he's a relatively young manager. He's not long finished his career as a professional footballer. He would have had so many hours of psychological tutoring, I would imagine, from people like yourself, Alex. And it was really shocking to me that he didn't think a bit more carefully about the way he was going to come across in that interview, because, like you say, we don't know what's going on behind closed doors, but his players will have seen that. They'd have picked up on what happened in front of the cameras, because everyone was picking up on it. It was kind of insane. I've rarely seen a manager lose it like that since the classic Keegan rant on Sky.
And I think, just quickly, as a sort of a bit of a contrast also, like, before I was a sports psychologist, and I think this, maybe I've spoken a bit before, but like, I think peak Mourinho, sort of Chelsea era Mourinho, would say conspiracy, and at Real he had all these conspiracy theories that UEFA were siding with Barcelona and all the rest of it, and like he would come out with that, but he would do that, and he would do that maybe after his team had lost, but he would come out and say it, and he wouldn't just come out and look a bit stroppy and say, if I speak now I will be banned for 6 weeks. He would come out and he would say, this is all clearly rigged. There is a global footballing conspiracy against me and my team, which would mean that then the back page the next day would be Mourinho blames global conspiracy. And like, you wouldn't get the heat on the players in the same way, because he would have taken it. Now, I think once Mourinho stopped being peak Mourinho, he started to throw his own players under the bus publicly, rather than finding like a kind of fictional baddie to aim for. And I just thought it was quite interesting, because like, I think Arteta kind of, I wondered, part of me was like, is he trying to do that? Is he trying to take the heat off his players? But he just clearly looked so shaken, and he then kind of didn't really say the controversial. He just kept saying like, oh, if I say this, it'll be controversial. And it's like, well, if he'd actually said it, if he'd taken a fine, you know, then he probably might have deflected a bit of heat. And instead, I think he just looked really panicked. And that I sense, or that I believe was probably then sensed by the players, right? And if you're feeling a bit shaken by the result, which I'm sure they were, you're then looking to your manager to be the sort of calm, authoritative figure who can sort of like confidently lead you through your last few games. And he's looks like he's about to burst into tears. Like that's not really what you want in that moment.
And that is how Arsenal played against Newcastle in their follow-up game. They were so sort of anxious from the very first minute. And St James's Park is not the kind of stadium where you can afford to show any weakness, because those fans are on you like a flash, and they were. And so I've said before that I expected Newcastle to give Arsenal a tough game, and I actually predicted that they would win that. I had no idea that they would dominate the game like they did. I was so shocked to see Newcastle have, like, I think at one point they had 68% possession against a possession team. Arsenal recently, at least, have become a possession side once again. It was incredible. And I honestly believe that is in large part down to the psychology of it. I really think that they managed it so poorly. I'd love to know what went on behind the scenes, whether Arteta's sort of reflected on that and realised the impact that his behaviour had. I'm sure that he would have had some feedback about the interview. I guess we'll see whether he learns from it next year and whether he behaves in the same way again.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, it's hard to know, right? And look, this is all speculation, but it's certainly hard to see how that reaction can be helpful, right? Like, so even if he's saying slightly different things behind the scenes, or is far more composed behind the scenes, or was far more composed by the time they came in for the next training session or whatever, that in that moment when you probably those players were looking to him for that kind of just like confidence, okay, that wasn't the result we were looking for, but you know, we can still, you know, it was still well within their own hands to come away with fourth. So, you know, you just got to focus on that, surely. But yeah, so it was a pretty interesting post-match to watch.
So another interesting aspect of Spurs' end of season run-in, and you've mentioned him already, the reintroduction of Emerson Royale in place of Matt Doherty, who obviously got injured at a really bad time for him. And Emerson Royale came into the team and really struggled. I think because we'd seen such an improvement in Doherty, it was like, oh, actually, the difference between the two now is significant. Plus, Doherty had created a really decent connection with Kulusevski. It looked like they were kind of having a... they were working well together and they'd created a partnership on that side. And then that was just lost in an instant. However, Emerson Royale, he kind of threw some positive reinforcement. He played himself back into form. And he partly did that through the use of compilations. And now everyone's just constantly tweeting about the Emerson Royale post-match compilations.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's brilliant. I was such a big fan of those when I'd see them come up. Like, we've definitely spoken before about the sort of low light reel that was kind of evident in the All or Nothing documentary where Mourinho put together a compilation of all the goals we conceded, and from a confidence perspective, that is pretty problematic. And so I just thought this was brilliant. And actually the strength of character to like put it out on social media of sort of like, here you go, like, was
this is me, warts and all.
Yeah, exactly. And that was what was most, I guess, impressive, was that it wasn't even necessarily that much of a highlight reel. Some of it was just like, okay, he'd like take the ball, he would receive a pass, and then, you know, in the compilation you'd see him like give it away or whatever, but he was clearly using it as a way of giving himself that sense of confidence and running through things that he thought he had done well. And again, I think there's probably a bit of a question of like, we don't know what was going on behind the scenes. So we don't know, like, if Conte is saying to him, like, here's what I need you working on, right? Do you know, your top priorities are to do this and do that. And maybe he was seeing that evidence in those compilations that weren't immediately evident to the, you know, the people who were just sort of having a bit of fun watching them, right? But for him, you know, it clearly, he was doing them for a reason, right? And I can only assume that was in large part because it gave him a boost in confidence. And, you know, certainly off the back of those compilations, his performance has picked up. You know, we can't for sure say that they definitely were, you know, in any, you know, we can't say how much they helped or if they helped, but I mean, he certainly turned his season around, you know, he went from being a real liability in those couple of games to winning man of the match, according to the Spurs fans, only a couple of games later, and was, you know, absolutely outstanding against some very good players along the way. So yeah, I think I don't know, I feel like there's a sort of a little bit of a kind of almost a lesson there for, you know, some up and coming footballers, you know, like, yeah, why not, like, go away and put together your own little kind of highlight package. You probably don't need to put them on social media, but there's something also about that I think is actually quite cool, right, of putting it out there as well.
I'd like to know a bit more about Emerson Royale's character. He wears his heart on his sleeve quite a bit, I think. Do you remember he scored, I think it was like the deflected cross he scored, and then he absolutely sprinted over to one area of the pitch and was like giving out to a group of or a section of fans who'd given him some abuse in the previous match, Spurs fans, that is. Yeah. And I was like, oh wow, okay, he really took that to heart, and he was very happy to kind of prove them wrong. So he's clearly someone that sort of, yeah, properly wears his heart on his sleeve. He's very expressive, very communicative, and like you say, really brave of him to put out a compilation that wasn't exactly like, I mean, that's why the fans loved it so much, because it wasn't just brilliance. It was like an average performance. Yeah. And it became sort of a cult hit. But then from that, he's become super popular.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, like, what a way to build, kind of almost instantly build a kind of cult status, right? Of like, you know, there was a photo that the Spurs official Twitter account dropped about off the back of the result yesterday of us kind of walking through the sort of like walking out towards the Champions League banner or whatever, and it's Kane, Son and Royale, and you're like, I mean, like,
the three amigos.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
obviously it's Kane, Son and Royale.
Clearly our three best players, right? Like, you know, does Hugo get in there as our club captain for the last decade? No.
Nope.
So yeah, I think he has like firmly cemented himself as a, you know, and even if he gets sold over the summer, which, you know, there's a really good chance he will, like, I think he will always be remembered fondly, and in part because of those videos. But I think they are a really helpful little snippet, you know, a little bit of kind of anecdotal evidence to show that, you know, yeah, going away and finding the positives in amongst what was, you know, those there were a few kind of really pretty poor or best average performances in there, but he really went away and found the best bits and used that as a platform to build on, and that's, you know, really, really admirable. It's not necessarily easy to do. And yeah, I think then probably, you know, to your point about him sort of like, you know, giving back, giving it some in front of some of the home fans. But, you know, like, I think there's probably also a little bit of kind of just using some of that sort of adversity to sort of fuel him. Right. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, that we've spoken a little bit about before as well, you know, like, that can be a bit of a double-edged sword. It can backfire when you sort of like, if you're trying to fuel yourself for sort of positive outcomes using really negative things, that can work for a while, but is it going to work indefinitely? Rarely. So, you know, like, for him, you know, using it in the moment, using it like to celebrate after he scored, using a little bit maybe of the backlash, even when he would, I don't know, maybe when he was putting out those compilations and then he's scouring through the results, you know, the interactions afterwards, and sort of finding the people who've said, nah, mate, you were rubbish. You know, maybe he was using that to sort of also hype himself up. But ultimately, he found a way to come good and was really, really outstanding as cover for Doherty.
Lovely stuff. So not just a useful PR exercise, but a self-help mechanism.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great stuff. Let's tackle some of the questions from our ex-subs. So this one, I feel like we might have tackled this at some level before. It's from Yagnesh Vadgama, who says, what are your recommendations for athletes when they hit that proverbial wall? More so on the mental health blocks that athletes sometimes find themselves in. I think we've spoken about hitting the wall before, but I think it's a really useful topic to talk about, because it's something that's not just athletes come up against, but that regular people like me, when I'm trying to run 5K, there's a wall sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, that can be, yeah, that wall can be kind of pretty intimidating, and sometimes kind of, you know, depending on what context you're talking about, almost sort of unavoidable. Like, I've never run a marathon, I know that I'll leave that up to Bardi, but, you know, my understanding is that there basically is a wall every time, kind of almost regardless of how many times you've done it and how much you've trained. Like, there will just be a point where a little part of you goes, I don't know if I can do this anymore. And so I think, you know, to some extent it's some of the same things that we've actually already spoken about, right? So it's sort of having, you know, having a sense of confidence and having taken the time through the training process to really kind of acknowledge the progress that you made and the successes that came along the way. So I would say that probably one of the phrases that I use the most with my clients, either individually or in kind of group work, is to celebrate your successes. And by successes, I mean the day-to-day bits and pieces. You know, I'm not talking like end of season, you know, kiss the cup kind of moment. Like, but like, okay, today I'm proud of myself for this and that. And just taking that moment to really appreciate that can be really helpful, and potentially even having sort of physical reminders of that. So again, one of the tools that I use a lot is literally having people write down those successes at the end of the day, write them down on a post-it note or something. If you want, you can throw that post-it away, but you know, having just taken that moment to write it down and pay attention to it ingrains it in your brain a little bit more. But if you keep that post-it, you keep it in a little jam jar or something, then as you go forward through time, eventually you've got this really powerful, very visual kind of physical reminder that you can hold in your hand and sort of can shake it around and see the little bits of paper moving around in there. And you know that that is your hard work. And so that can be really helpful going into an event or something where you know you've done that work. You've got that evidence base for like, yeah, I'm ready. I'm prepared for this. So that can be really helpful. And then obviously just knowing that you've done, if you've done that kind of thing before, right? So if it's not your first marathon, right? Knowing that you've done it before, right? Okay, yeah, I've felt this way before. I've had these doubts before, but I can move past them. I know that. But also, you know, sometimes it's a bit more about finding something that's not quite exactly the same. So, you know, if I'm working with I've worked with clients maybe sometimes where they've been told they have to kind of adapt their game or, you know, whatever, and they've had to change how they play because a new manager's come in or something like that. And I'll sort of talk to them. I'll be like, okay, well, like, talk to me about other times you've been adaptable. So not just within your footballing career, but like, okay, right. So like you moved halfway across the country to join this team. All right, well, that's adaptability. Like, you know, oh, so, you know, and you can just start to kind of like take some of those little kind of attributes or kind of psychological traits, and you can kind of ask them to demonstrate that and keep hold of those concepts. And that can just be a sort of a nice little thing. So, you know, any sense of like, oh, that time that you had to show that resilience and that determination and that grit to keep going through something that was a bit miserable or a bit difficult, like that could be useful for finishing that marathon or whatever that situation is. So those can be some sort of quite helpful little kind of tools along the way. There are then also some more, I guess, kind of using sort of traditional techniques that come out of the specific type of sports psychology practice that I like, which is called ACT, which is the acceptance and commitment therapy. And there's some stuff in there about sort of one of the techniques is called like name the narrative or name the voice. So like if you know that voice kind of tends to get a little bit louder and starts to get a bit, you know, those doubts start creeping in and that voice kind of comes in, you don't necessarily want to sort of like tell that voice to kind of shut up, and you're not trying to necessarily stop it or kind of completely cancel it out. But what you might be able to say to it is like, I've heard this story before, like I've heard these doubts before. And actually one of the sort of kind of takeaway little tasks from this kind of work is that you can actually even, you might even write that the narrative down on a piece of paper that you keep in your wallet or potentially on the notes function on your phone. And you literally write down like, oh, the doubtful voice. And like, he's going to come to me and he's going to say X, Y, and Z. And I know he's going to say it at about this point in whatever it is I'm competing at. So that when he does, when that voice starts to kind of get a little bit louder, you can literally go, I've heard this before. Look, I've heard it so many times. I know exactly what you're going to say. I've even written it down before you even have a chance to say it. And so it's just a case of sort of like, which sounds a bit mental because you're kind of having this weird sort of dialogue in your own head. And it's kind of a little bit sort of angel on one shoulder, devil on the other. But, you know, you can essentially say to that voice, like, listen, and another part of the sort of acceptance commitment therapy is like, that voice isn't bad. It's just not quite helpful in that moment. So it's a bit of a case of sort of saying like, thanks so much. I know you're trying to help, but you're not helpful because I really want to finish this marathon. So thank you. I know what you're going to say. I've taken it on board because I've heard it before. But actually right now, I'm just going to focus on counting my strides and just sort of keep pushing on. I'm just going to get to that tree. And then I'm going to keep pushing on.
I think that's really interesting. There's a lot of preparation involved, isn't there? That these things aren't I mean, in some senses, you can do them in the moment, but it would really help to have prepared yourself for that so that when it happens, you're ready for it and you know what's coming next. So, yeah, I mean, when people talk about marathon training, a lot of that training is about, you know, getting the miles in. But I'm sure from what you've just said that mentally preparing yourself is equally as important as the sort of physical miles as well to prepare your muscles and your feet.
Yeah, I think
sorry,
so.
Go on.
Yeah. I think you're spot on with that. I think, you know, they obviously happen at the same time, right? It's like as you're pushing yourself through those training runs and building up that physical stamina, yeah, you're also starting to work on those psychological tools that you can call on in those moments when it gets a bit painful.
For sure.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This one is from a Damalist who says, apologies if I might misunderstand what you do, but is there a difference between helping sports people prepare for high performance versus winning? Is a different approach ever dictated by head coach in this way, or do different athletes ask for a particular approach, or is there no material difference between the two? So win now versus general high performance. Any thoughts on that, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, I would kind of urge my clients to sort of more see the winning almost as a byproduct of the performance. So it's sort of about learning the processes, doing the right things, and then the results come from that, so that you kind of, you aren't necessarily either defining yourself or a given match or a given season potentially by the results. So that's helpful for a number of reasons. Again, coming back to control, you can control the processes far more than you can control the actual result, right? And everyone can think of matches where, you know, I think everyone was predicting that Tim Krul would do this potentially on Sunday, right? But, you know, where, you know, the team has 80 something percent possession, 40 shots on target. I mean, Tim Krul's done it to us before away at Newcastle, I think, several years ago. But, you know, millions of shots on target and the goalkeeper just sort of suddenly is parrying them all away, and like, you've done all the processes right, but the result hasn't gone your way, right? So you've kind of got two options at that point. Do you either sort of go, well, the processes are wrong, well, no, not really, or do you kind of prioritize, well, okay, you know, so that's sort of looking only at the result, or do you say, well, that result is just a bit of a fluke, it's a rarity, it's an anomaly, but actually we can be really proud of how we played, and 9 times out of 10 or even 99 times out of 100, if you play that way, you win that game. So if you know, and certainly within, depends a little bit, I guess, on the sport to some extent, how much direct relationship there is between the performance and the result. So my own sporting background was swimming, right? Like, they're very much like, if you do the processes right, it will pretty much, you're pretty much certain it's going to give you the time you're aiming for. Now, that may not win if someone else has done their preparation even a slightly bit better and therefore they've gone faster, but you kind of have a pretty close relationship there. When you're talking about 11 players against 11 players with a ref, two assistant refs, a VAR, crowd, all the rest of it, you know, there's so many different dynamics in that, that you as one individual player, you've got a relatively small input on how the actual result turns out. And even as 11 players, you've actually got surprisingly little influence on how the result turns out. So in that sense, I would kind of generally urge people to sort of think about that process rather than the, you know, so therefore kind of focusing more on that sort of like the high performance element of it rather than thinking purely about the winning. The other thing is that if you start thinking purely about the winning, I mean, you're not going to win every match, right? So if you then lose, how do you deal with that, right? Do you, like, if you have become, you know, someone who defines themselves purely by that, then when those moments don't go your way, for whatever reason, whether it's because of a good performance or that's just being unlucky or a bad performance that kind of warranted losing, like, then where do you go from there? And that can start to really shake confidence, shake that self-esteem, and that can start sort of a pretty unhelpful spiral in those moments. And then finally, if you're kind of focusing a little bit more on the sort of processes, like I was saying a bit earlier, right, is some of those psychological characteristics can be transferable, right? And so I guess thinking even longer term, like maybe through into sort of retirement and whatever, if you can look back on yourself and be like, listen, I know I am hardworking and resilient and adaptable, then you're probably in a better position when your sport ends, your sporting career ends, that you can kind of go, cool, and those are all features I can take out into whatever I do next, whether that's being, you know, if you're a professional footballer, maybe you go and be a pundit, or maybe you just spend all your time on the golf course or whatever it is, but, you know, you can take those with you. Whereas if you're spending your whole time thinking, oh, well, there was that one crucial final that I didn't win, like that's what's going to define me for the rest of my life, well, that's pretty miserable, because, you know, as a sports person, kind of almost any level, you've got a pretty short career span where you can do it to the sort of best of your ability before age is going to start to take its toll. And so at that point, you're like, well, all right, how do you deal with that now, right? So, you know, and again, then you can start to sort of, at least you can focus on the processes, right? Even if you're doing it more recreationally, you can be like, oh, well, I'm still having fun learning the elements or going through the processes and getting the sense of satisfaction out of that. Lots of reasons why I would kind of try and trend towards, or, you know, try and get my clients to start thinking in that kind of mindset.
It's really fascinating that the art of sports psychology in this respect tallies basically with how I prefer to analyze football matches anyway. I mean, the amount of discussions I've had, and to be fair, less so nowadays, because people have adjusted to things like expected goals, expected assists, and, you know, some of the deep dive data metrics. But the amount of times I had a conversation on Twitter where someone would say, yeah, but it was 2-1, we lost 2-1. Why would you look at expected goals? We lost 2-1. It's like, actually, no, I'm looking at some of the underlying factors around the performance. I'm looking at the process. I'm looking at what we got right on the pitch. There's a predictor for future performance. You're simply looking at what happened in this match, where, as you say, Alex, there are so many variables. We had a dodgy penalty given against us, or we had our key player go off injured after 10 minutes. These things happen in football and they skew results. And I remember Brendan Rodgers became a bit of a meme for bigging up the possession stats for his team. But it's like, that was clearly a big part of the process for him. Part of their way of winning was to have a lot of possession. So he saw that as a success. And you might say, yes, it's stale possession as an analyst, but that's a viable defensive tactic. To have the ball means the opposition is not having the ball. He's seeing that as his players fulfilling one of his strategies to win the game, and then something else happened and they lost or whatever. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's absolutely fascinating. And generally, I mean, and this is, as I get older, I really notice that I am so much more willing to take a kind of longer term approach to football. And I think that's why I was so adamant that we would finish in the top four this year, because I wasn't being judgmental in the moment. I was able to sort of stand back and say, actually, I can see tactically how well the players are adapting to the system. Each game, there's an incremental improvement. Conte's kind of, the message is getting through. And I was able to say, okay, and we've got 15 games left. That's 45 points to play for. And I'm seeing an improvement. So extrapolating that, I can see a considerable improvement to come. And I found that really, really helpful for my own kind of optimism as a Spurs fan. In contrast to that, it's why when Mourinho was doing well, I was so doubtful and so pessimistic and so down, because the performance steps that I was hoping to see just weren't there. There was no kind of I couldn't see what the process was. I couldn't understand what the tactics were aside from, you know, get it to Kane, he'll release Son. And that was unsustainable. It was clearly unsustainable. It worked brilliantly in some matches, notably against Southampton, and then it just stopped working because the opposition were able to stop it. And that kind of explains why I felt so pessimistic, even when we were getting the win. I found this question really interesting in relation to both of those things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a lot in that makes sense. Like, and I think also just as a, yeah, I think as a player or as a manager, like you kind of, there's so much volatility, so much unpredictability that if you are just sort of living by whether you win or lose, like it would just be too tumultuous, right? Like it would just be too kind of painful and wearing, you know, on the days that it doesn't go to plan. I think in amongst that, yeah, like I think Conte has been, yeah, really resolute and has had faith in that process and has given it that sense. The other thing, actually, sorry, just quickly, is also if you know what your processes are going to be, those processes shouldn't really change. You know, you maybe change them, tweak them a little bit depending on who your opposition is. But the other nice thing about it is that the processes don't care what's on the line, right? So actually, like going into a match against Norwich where you know you have to win and ideally you'd like to get Sonny to score a goal or two, like all of a sudden those processes don't really matter. Don't really care about the fact that there's a Champions League spot on the line, right? You're just, okay, I pass there, I move here, then I'm going to receive it from that person, and I know that so-and-so is making the run there. Those are kind of all the same, regardless of whether it's the first match of the season or the last. And so all of a sudden, if that's what you're focusing on, rather than we've got to win this game because there's a Champions League place on the line, or we've got to win this game because it's a Champions League final, then all of a sudden, like, that can really throw you as well, because there will naturally be pressure and expectation and all the rest of it that could be unhelpful. Whereas if you're just sort of more focused on, all right, I know what my game is, I know where I'm meant to be, I know what I'm meant to do, I know when I'm meant to look for so-and-so making this run, you know, that's kind of a constant, right? And again, it's very controllable.
Mm. Really, really interesting. This is from Adam W., who says, how can you scout a player's propensity to gel with a new teammate and settle in a new culture? Seems like we've got this wrong on a few occasions over the years, e.g. in Ndombele and Brian Hill, Brian Hill seems to have had a homesickness, which is a tricky one, I guess, to predict. Do you think there's anything that Spurs could be doing in terms of their scouting of a player's personality type, I suppose?
I think this will be really tricky. I think it's a really interesting question. It's a really good one. I think, I guess, put simply, I'm not sure there really is much that could be done. There are kind of often rumours about sort of managers kind of talking to people. And I think Poch sort of did this a good amount, like of almost sort of like slightly kind of interviewing certain players before signing them to sort of get a sense of whether they would fit. But there are so many variables there again, right? Like, you know, is someone going to, okay, maybe they're going to absolutely love moving to London, but they're going to hate one of the teammates, you know, and like, you know, or vice versa. They love all their teammates, but they just really miss home, or they miss one aspect of home, you know, to a huge extent. And so trying to figure that out would be really hard. You could conceivably try and use some of the psychometric tests and kind of the kind of personality, they're kind of basically personality tests to sort of get a sense of that. I personally have, I'm a bit skeptical about how useful those are in general. But I think the other thing is that actually, you know, very often you would sort of tend to approach a kind of group dynamic, assuming that you'd have like a little bit of a mix. Potentially by the time you're talking about ultra, ultra elite sports people, which you would be with a Premier League football team, right? Like you are probably going to get a lot of people who are extremely driven, you know, who are very resilient, who have pushed through, made it through all of the excruciating rounds of academies, have survived those, you know, have played at the highest levels, have transferred, bounced around clubs and countries all over Europe to get to where they're going to be, you're going to get, I suspect you're probably going to get relatively similar output from a lot of those psychometric tests anyway. So then where does that leave you, right? You maybe Ndombele gets the same score as Kulishevsky, and you go, oh, well, but it worked for Ndombele. Oh, sorry, it worked for Deki, but it didn't work for Ndombele. So you kind of, how do you sort of differentiate there? And yeah, I think at the end of the day, humans are just so complicated, so complex. And then you add that into, you know, like, you're not even talking one-on-one. It's basically impossible to predict whether one person is going to get on well with another person, let alone you throw them into a squad of however many people, a manager, assistant managers, physios, support staff, all the rest of it. So I think it's probably less a case of trying to screen in advance and probably more about what you can do when they do arrive to help them bed in. And I actually thought that was one of the really interesting things about the All or Nothing documentary, was sort of seeing a bit of that behind the scenes of the work that does go into that to sort of help those players settle in. And, you know, but at the end of the day, that's also not going to be foolproof. And again, I think there's also, you know, to what extent was that really the problem with Ndombele? Was it really the problem with Hill, or, you know, or not? And again, that's quite speculative. It may have been one issue of 100. Maybe it was the most important, maybe it was the least important. But yeah, so it's a tricky one to do. But I think, yeah, I would try and focus more on getting them settled in, identifying common features, common values, common goals, mm-hmm. and sort of focusing on that kind of stuff to build that sort of sense of team camaraderie and togetherness mm-hmm. and all the rest of it.
Mm, I like that a lot. So it's kind of like, accept that there are many variables that you're not going to be able to control. So control the controllables, do the things you can do to help players settle in, and don't worry in advance about all the things that could go wrong, I suppose. And as you were talking, I was wondering whether we have kind of a mentor system or like a buddy system. I know that in my place of work, when a new starter joins, it's kind of part of their induction. It's built in that we assign them a mentor or a buddy, someone to talk to if they're having a tough time. And I'd love to know if Spurs do that, whether it's, you know, they do have that player liaison. So I'm sure he acts as that. But I mean, he can't do that for every player. He would never have time to spend with every player. So I wonder if they like have senior players within the squad who take on a sort of mentoring role, either officially or unofficially. I'd imagine that would be a good thing to do, especially someone who's made that move before and can kind of talk to the experiences of settling into a new environment. Really, really interesting.
Yeah, and I think that kind of, you know, the buddy system is really helpful. And I think also just sort of more broadly, right, like there's going to be other things like just sort of making that player feel wanted, feeling, you know, respected, all the rest of it, right? And so making sure that they're not being kind of isolated. And that's also really hard, right? Because like almost by definition, a new signing's gonna take a little while before you're gonna start them, right? Like that's just really tricky. And also then that's a tricky one as well, because like, what does that do to the confidence of the person who gets dropped, right? Like they've been playing for that manager or whatever, they've been trying their hardest, and then all of a sudden in comes this new person and they've just immediately been promoted to the starting 11. That's pretty rough as well. So as the manager, that's a really delicate balance to try and strike, right? You want the new player to feel wanted and appreciated. You don't want to totally burn bridges with the player who's going to be on the bench from now on. Yeah, it's really hard. And yeah, it's a very, very tricky thing. Mm. I really, really enjoy being a sports psychologist. I would not want to be a football manager. That is a really hard job. I'm glad I don't have to. I would never have to make any of the sort of decisions to drop players or you know, who do you start, who do you drop. Those are really hard.
Yeah, trying to sort of manage that at a micro level must just be so difficult. And I was just thinking of, because you mentioned Kulusevski, you know, coming in halfway through a season, and then in comparison to Brian Heal, who joined at the beginning of the season and had a bit more time to settle, it's a really interesting comparison. It's similar age, inexperienced players, but lots and lots of promise. obviously Kulusevski's played more matches, is a bit more established, but you know, coming to a foreign country at a young age, big benefit for Kulusevski is that he speaks really good English, which I assume would have made it a lot easier for him to communicate with his teammates and perhaps settle in better. Also was coming into a team that was doing well, whereas Hill came into a team that was struggling with a manager, Nuno, who didn't really sort of have a system, to put it brutally, and didn't quite know where Brian Hill was going to play, as he ended up playing as a winger, and then also as a number eight at times. Kulusevski's had a very defined role instantly in a system that works. Really, there's an interesting comparison there. And I think you can say the same about Ndombele and Bentancur. You know, Ndombele came in, didn't play initially, had to really fight to come into the team, and then played as a 10, played as an 8. The team was struggling at that point. Bentancur has come into a much more established team that's sort of moving in the right direction, alongside Huibier, who is a steady Eddie player, whereas Ndombele would have been coming in alongside, would have been Sissoko and Winks at the time, wouldn't it? So there's some interesting comparisons.
Yeah, and I think also just, you know, in amongst all of that, right, is like you could easily make a case, kind of whether you came in before a season or midway through a season, of what would be helpful and unhelpful, right? And it would be so different for some people. So like for someone to come in midway through a season, okay, right, you've just moved to a new country, but all of a sudden you're kind of in at the deep end, you kind of don't have time to be homesick because you're on a team bus and then you're on a team plane and you've got training and matches and, you know, all the rest of it. Or are you the type of person who so maybe that works for someone, maybe that worked for Kulusevski, but wouldn't have worked. He actually may have, therefore, complete speculation, he may have struggled actually if he'd been brought in July and had a full preseason of kind of with a bit of sort of twiddling his thumbs and missing home or missing, you know, Italy and feeling a bit lonely and a bit directionless because actually it's ages until the season starts. And just as he's trying to get settled in and maybe getting to grips with it, there's a preseason tour and he's, you know, you can kind of see how that might go either way, right? But then similarly, like someone might really appreciate the preseason because it gives them a chance to settle in, they feel prepared, they feel embedded with the team, they, you know, if they're someone who's, you know, if they're deriving a lot of confidence from the processes, right, maybe they feel like they really need that, and therefore a January switch would be really tricky for them to get their head around. You know, you can really see how, you know, it could be really hard. And I guess coming back to the kind of initial question of like, how can you figure out if a player is going to gel or not? It's like those in and of themselves are just sort of tricky questions, right? Like, and I don't know quite how you would get to grips with that, right? Would you talk to someone in January and go like, are you the type of player who's going to thrive from being thrown in at the deep end if we start you on Saturday, right? Like, what player is going to say no, right? Like they're going to feel pretty compelled to say, yeah, boss, I can, I'm good to go, right? And they probably would want to, right? But are they actually going to thrive or not? So yeah, it's hard, right? Like, and people will exist on a spectrum of what they would prefer from that situation.
Absolutely. I mean, I think Dele's an interesting case study here as well with his switch to Everton, because you would imagine that his agent would have been saying to Everton and Frank Lampard, you know, he's in a rotten place at Spurs, he's not getting in the team, he hasn't had a consistent run for all this time, you know, this move will come just at the right time, it will give him such a boost and he'll hit the ground running and all these things. But actually, when he arrived, not only was he in a bad place, and so, you know, there's a short-term uplift of, yes, I'm happy to be out of that situation, I've got something new to look forward to, but physically his condition's not good, so he's not ready to play immediately, which instantly kind of puts him back into the, oh god, I'm not playing, and now I'm not in the team, and now and it's a reminder of all the bad stuff that's happened over the past few weeks, and he's had to kind of fight to get back in the team. Yeah, there's so many variables. It's so difficult to plan for any of this, isn't it?
Yeah, and particularly, you know, generally autonomy and a sense of sort of being able to control your own destiny is really helpful, right? And football's a really, really weird world there. You know, like there really aren't that many professional sports where you can just be like up and traded at the drop of a hat in the same way, you know, like there's a handful of sort of high-end professional sports globally where that happens, right? But like for the most part, it's not really the case, right? Like most people, you join you know, your local sports team and you play for them until you choose to move house or, you know, to move to a different part of the country or something, right? But generally that doesn't happen. So the idea that, like, there you are, you've been playing for this team for however long, and then all of a sudden, like, you're no longer in favor and you're being, you know, carted off to kind of whoever will take you, right? And you may not even have, you know, depending on who you are, but like the number of players who can really control their own destiny there. I mean, we've just seen with Mbappe, right? He really had a choice about whether he stayed at PSG or went to Real. Like, great, he's got that autonomy, but very clearly, like, that's not the case. If you're someone who's a bit out of favor, you'll go wherever someone will take you or whoever will offer you the most amount of money. So, or sorry, offer the club the most amount of money for you. So yeah, it's really hard, and how you kind of deal with that when you sort of, you've come from a sense, you've sensed feeling a bit unwanted, and now you're sort of turning up somewhere where you maybe didn't want to be. It's quite hard to get over that. Mm. You can imagine.
This has been a very interesting and very wide-ranging chat, as ever, Alex. Really appreciate it. I'm sure the ex-subs will be delighted that you've answered their questions, that you're the most requested repeat guests, mm-hmm. repeat guest on the Discord. People love to hear your thoughts and things. So if anyone has any follow-up questions for Alex, we'll definitely get back on in the future. So do make sure you send them in. How do people find out about you and your work? If someone wanted to book you to work with them or their sports team, how would they go about doing that?
So to book me, the best way is to go to the company that I work for, which is called Optimize Potential. So the website is optimizepotentialsport.com, and you can, there's a little contact form there, so you could just fill that in saying what you want, and if you want, you can specifically request me, but everyone I work with is also brilliant. And then you can also, yeah, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Alex Doyle, and I think I'm on Instagram as at Alex Doyle Sports Psych with some underscores somewhere in there, but my last name is very rare, so if you kind of just look for Stoyle, Stoyel, I'm probably going to pop up pretty soon.
Nice, that's the benefit of having an unusual surname, I guess.
It is
cool. Thank you so much. Pleasure to catch up with you. I'll let you go now and do bath time with your little girl.
Thank you very much. Yeah, and pleasure as always to chat to you. And yeah, what a great season in the end. That was a cracker.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Bardi for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindmer for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at Davey Shambles and his SoundCloud D Lindmer. Do check him out. He's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.